everyone has a God. Even those who profess to worship no God, yet have something in their lives which finds pride of place, something which they put above all else in their hearts and their affections, and that becomes their God. For some, it may be something tangible, a motor car, a home. For others, something more abstract, ambition, education, the family. But all have a God of some kind or another. I used to have working with me a young lady who worshipped a picture on her wall. That was her God. She belonged to a family who worshipped many gods, and they each chose the particular God that they would worship. She had chosen this one and knelt before it. The great difference, brethren and sisters, between people of that kind and ourselves is that while most men and women choose their God, God has chosen us. That's the difference, isn't it? We did not choose him. The true and living God chooses his subjects, not the other way round. That's point one, then. God has chosen us. But once you have a God, there appears to be something almost inherent in human nature that wants to provide a place for God. Let me illustrate what I mean. Come for a moment to the 28th of Genesis, and you will see there how it seems to arise almost automatically in the mind of the patriarch Jacob that having a God, one should wish to retain him and provide him a dwelling place. Genesis chapter 28 concerns Jacob's arrival at Bethel, the very house of God. In verse 16, Jacob awaked out of his sleep, and he said, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not." And he was afraid, and he said, "How dreadful is this place! This is none other but the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." And then, verse 20, Jacob vowed a vow, saying, "If God will be with me, and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God, and this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee." Now, it's possible to read those verses in one of two ways. It's possible to regard Jacob as trying to make some kind of a bargain with God. If God will be my God, then I'll do this and that and the other. That's one way of looking at it, and Jacob may well have been thinking along those mercenary terms. We cannot be sure. There is another alternative, however, isn't there? And that is that Jacob was saying in these words that if God will indeed be my God and bring me again to this place, then I shall know that he is my God. I shall know that he cares for me and has provided for me, and I will build him a house. And that seems to be the implication of the end of verse 21 and verse 22. If God will be my God, will keep me in the way that I go, and give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. And the inference seems to be, indeed, I shall know that he is my God, that he is with me, and this stone which I have set him for a pillar will be God's house. Jacob anxious then, if God be his God indeed, to build him a house, to make him a dwelling place, to provide some means of retaining God. Come over to the 15th of Exodus and see the same thought illustrated in the words of Moses and the children of Israel so newly brought out of Egypt. Exodus chapter 15 and the very first verse, where Israel have been redeemed from bondage and slavery, have seen the Egyptians, anxious to pursue them, washed up upon the shores of the Red Sea, and now sing their song of triumph to God. Then sang Moses and the children of Israel this song unto the Lord, and spake, saying, "I will sing unto the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider hath he thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will prepare him an habitation. My father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name. And you see, brethren and sisters, by the juxtaposition of those phrases again, that there seems to be something almost automatic in what Moses and the children of Israel are saying here. The middle of verse 2 there, he is my God, and I will prepare him an habitation. Seems to be a natural part of their thinking that if you have a God, you prepare him a house. The one seems to follow on the other as a natural consequence of it. He is my God, and I will build him a house. And the juxtaposition of those phrases suggests again that that ought to be a natural line of thought. Psalm 132 suggests the same thing, perhaps. Here, Psalm 132, a psalm of degrees. Verse 4 says, I will not give sleep to mine eyes or slumber to mine eyelids until I find out a place for the Lord and habitation for the mighty God of Jacob. So there is expressed the intense desire of the psalmist in this case to provide God a dwelling place, his desire to retain his God in some way, to hang on to him, to build him a house, a permanent abode, that he might retain his God. I will not give sleep to mine eyes nor slumber to mine eyelids until I find out a place for the Lord. Let's make that our second point then, brethren and sisters. There seems in the minds of some of these faithful of the Old Testament to be nothing more natural than, if you have a God, to want to build him a dwelling place. And that indeed was pleasing to God. God wished to have a dwelling. He wished to dwell amongst his people. If we can turn to Deuteronomy chapter 12, we shall find that God did not, however, wish to dwell in any place. And the children of Israel were particularly instructed about how and where they would worship God. They were not to make him a house of their choosing in any old place that they thought fit. They were to set aside one place which the Lord thy God shall choose, a place of God's own choosing, where he would be pleased to put his name. Deuteronomy 12 and the 13th verse points out to the people of Israel that they were not to follow the habits and the actions of the nations whom they displaced in the land of Canaan. Verse 13 of Deuteronomy 12, take heed to thyself that thou offer not thy burnt offerings in every place that thou seest, but in the place which the Lord shall choose in one of thy tribes, there thou shalt offer thy burnt offerings, and there thou shalt do all that I command thee. Take heed to thyself that thou do not offer in any place that thou seest. Not any old place would do, not the place of their choosing would be sufficient. That which God alone would point out and mark out for them was to be the place to which they must come. The nations, their predecessors in Canaan, had worshipped their gods in all kinds of places. They had built altars and high places under every green tree and on every high hill. Groves abounded. They were not to follow the abominations of those nations. They had not chosen God. God had chosen them, and God would point out for them a place where they could come into his presence. That place, brethren and sisters, would demand a journey. One or two people, of course, would be living local to wherever it was that God chose. But for the majority, it would mean inconvenience, effort, journeying. It would mean leaving home to come out to the place of God's choosing. And that also is evident from verses in this chapter, Deuteronomy 12 and verse 5. Verse 3 and 4 show again the habits of the nations who were thrown out before Israel. And verse 5 says, but unto the place which the Lord your God shall choose out of all your tribes to put his name there, even unto his habitation shall ye seek, and thither thou shalt come. So God was well aware that this would mean effort and inconvenience on the part of many, and he demanded that a journey should be made. Verse 26 of the same chapter. Only thy holy things which thou hast, and thy vows thou shalt take, and go unto the place which the Lord shall choose. There was then always a need to make the journey, to make the effort, and to come out to the place of God's choosing. And of course that's consistent with what we know of God and the calling of the faithful. To Abraham God had said, "Get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee." God had chosen the place beforehand. This is only consistent, isn't it, with the oath that God had made to their fathers initially. Get thee out. A journey was essential if Abraham was to please God. Perhaps we can come to Hebrews 11 and see just what emphasis the writer of Hebrews chapter is about. It's not faith plus works, as though they're two separate commodities. It's a working faith. It's a faith that is effective, a faith in operation that James is really talking about in his epistle. He illustrates it by saying, "Thou believest that there is one God, thou doest well. The devils also believe and tremble." In other words, James is saying, you believe in one God, that's fine. But so do the demons. It does nothing for them. It just frightens them silly. They tremble about it. Doesn't have any implications for their lives. Doesn't mean anything to them. And that's James's illustration. That wilt thou know then, he says, O vain man, that faith without works is dead. If you believe in one God, you must do something about it. That's the corollary. And so it is here. Hebrews 11 is concerned with men who did something about their faith, who acted upon their belief. And here the apostle is at pains to show that Abraham and others came out, made that necessary journey. Verse 13. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims in the earth. They were en route. They were journeyers, pilgrims, making a journey to the place that God would show them. They confessed that. They didn't see the promises fulfilled to them. They embraced them and hugged them to themselves. The term that the apostle uses is delightful, isn't it? That's the way they thought about the promises of God. And that had an implication for their lives. It made them strangers or foreigners in the world. They didn't belong here. They were men of no fixed abode in our world. A foreigner is someone who probably doesn't know his way around, may not be acquainted with the language, and certainly has no rights. Sometimes there are now reciprocal health agreements between countries, but by and large, a man of one nationality has no rights in another country. And that's how these men felt. They had no claims on the world, no rights there. They didn't belong to it. They were foreigners, out of place, fish out of water, here in the earth, en route to the place that God would show them. Verses 14 and 15, they that say such things declare plainly by their conduct that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. If they had wanted to go back, they were free agents, and they could at any time have returned. If ever Abraham had looked back with longing to Ur of the Chaldees, there was nothing to prevent him retracing his steps. Had he so desired, he could have gone back. But he didn't. He was putting his faith into operation. He knew that this journey was necessary if he was to worship God acceptably. And this chapter 11 is very much in the context of Hebrews. It arises out of what the apostle has said at the end of chapter 10 here about drawing back. He says, "The just shall live by faith, but if any man draw back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him." And giving us the benefit of the doubt, he says, "But we are not of them that draw back unto perdition, unto being lost, but of them that believe to the saving of the soul. He's persuaded better things of us than wanting to go back, just as Abraham might have had opportunity to return but did not. So we, he says, with them seek a country and a city whose builder and whose maker is God. There are other instances of faith in this chapter as well, of course, besides Abraham, and some of them are quite remarkable. Without looking at the verses for the moment, think about Joseph, who is mentioned here. If you or I were to be writing such a chapter as this, brethren and sisters, I suspect that we would have quite a list of things that we might say about Joseph and his faith. We might think of him in terms of his dreams. We might think of him in terms of his conduct before his brethren and all that he suffered at their hand, being thrown into the pit and so on, delivered into the hands of the Midianites, taken down into Egypt, sold to Potiphar and a slave in Potiphar's house. Some of us would want to mention as the highlight of his faithful life his conduct before Potiphar's wife, the way in which she avoided temptation and slipped away and then was unjustly blamed and thrown into prison. Some of us would be struck by his faith in prison, the way in which he laboured without complaint and became so trusted there by the prison guard. And then interpreting the dreams was promptly forgotten by the butler when he was restored to Pharaoh's service. And some of us would think about Joseph before Pharaoh, serving him and being the viceroy of Egypt, and then his brothers coming to him and his testing of them and his mercy in forgiving them and showing no animosity, not holding a grudge, not wanting vengeance. A marvelously faithful man was Joseph. And if now you look at these verses in Hebrews 11, brethren and sisters, it isn't one of those things that this writer mentions. Not one. Instead, as an illustration of the faith of Joseph, this apostle picks something that I have to admit would not have crossed my mind at all, and I doubt very much whether it would have crossed yours. The illustration that he picks of Joseph's faith concerns something that Joseph said as he was dying. Verse 22, by faith Joseph, when he died, made mention of the departing of the children of Israel and gave commandment concerning his bones. That's remarkable, isn't it? Wouldn't even have crossed my mind. I doubt very much whether you'd have thought of it either. And yet, brethren and sisters, if you were writing Hebrews 11, you wouldn't pick the worst example of faith you could think of, would you? If you're illustrating a point, obviously you pick the best supporting evidence you can find. And in this writer's mind, this was the best illustration of Joseph's faith. That's amazing, isn't it? That Joseph's faith was illustrated better in this incident than in any other way. It wasn't the things he did, it wasn't his righteousness, it was his belief in God. But when he died, led him to say to his brothers, when God takes you back to the land of promise, not if you go. Joseph was fully persuaded in his heart, when you go back to the land of promise, be sure to take my bones with you. And that is the mark of his faith in God, desiring to belong to God and God's land, the place that God had chosen and sworn to give to his father Jacob, his grandfather Isaac, and his great-grandfather Abraham. And it is in that, brethren and sisters, that the faith of Joseph is manifest. This chapter goes on to speak about Moses, who refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, refused Egypt and all its glitter and tinsel, all its education and wealth, all its military training and might. All those he put on one side to identify himself with God's people, to identify himself with their cause and the place that God had chosen and would take them to. You notice that Moses didn't wait until the decision was forced upon him. He was willing, brethren and sisters, to make the sacrifice before such a situation arose. Moses chose, this writer says. He didn't wait until the decision was thrust on him and he had to make up his mind. He wanted to belong to God and God's people and God's land, and he chose willingly. Verse 25, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to endure the pleasures of sin, even for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. For he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. He was another who saw the invisible, could look with the eye of faith, and desire the place that God had chosen. For that he was willing to make sacrifices. And it's interesting that when we go on in chapter 12 of this letter to look at the supreme example of faith in our Lord Jesus Christ, and it used to puzzle me why Jesus wasn't mentioned in Hebrews 11, and it's because, of course, the climax of this list is in chapter 12. It's there that we meet the author and finisher of our faith. And it's interesting that as the apostle introduces us to Jesus, he uses a phrase again which is straight out of Deuteronomy. A phrase which concerns Israel and their moving to the place that God had chosen. Their looking to the land. And he says, verse 2, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross and even despised the shame. That phrase, set before him, is straight out of Deuteronomy. It's the phrase that Moses uses repeatedly for the children of Israel, that new generation, as they stood on the threshold of the promised land, and he urged them to go in and to be faithful and not to fail as the previous generation had. And Moses says, this is the land that the Lord has set before you. Go up and possess it. And Jesus, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross. Let's go back to Deuteronomy then, that place that was set before Israel, and notice again how that God was not only choosing the place itself, but all the way there. Consistently through the wilderness, God had shown his people that there was to be a place of his choice, for he had chosen the place of their dwelling everywhere that they had travelled. Every place that they stopped in the wilderness was a place of God's choosing. They never encamped at their own will and their own whim. They always halted their encampment at the place that God chose. Deuteronomy chapter 1. This is the chapter that highlights their inability to see this fact. Their short-sightedness again. The way in which they felt that they should be choosing the place and did not fully appreciate that it was a place of God's choice. Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse 22, Moses says, and ye came near unto me, every one of you, and said, we will send men before us, and they shall search us out the land, and bring us word again by what way we must go off, and into what cities we shall come. And the saying pleased me well, and I took 12 men of you, one of a tribe, and the 12 spies were sent out, and 10 brought back the evil report, and there was disaster, brethren and sisters, because Israel had failed to realize that it was God who went before them to see by what way they should come and to choose their resting place. It wasn't that Joshua and Caleb set out to be faithful, incidentally, was it? Wasn't that Joshua and Caleb had a little discussion about it and said, now, what can we do to help along the children of Israel? What can we say to encourage them and take back a faithful report? It was just the way they saw things. It was just an attitude of mind that they had. To them, it was a way of life. They didn't know they were being faithful. They weren't trying to be faithful. It was just the way they looked at things. In all fairness, the same was true of the 10, in a different way. They didn't plot and scheme to foul the path of Israel either, did they? They didn't say, now, what can we do to cause the nation to fall? What can we do to hinder their progress and stop them getting into this land? They didn't discuss it in those sort of terms and deliberately take back an evil report. It was just that they saw things differently. Theirs was a different attitude of mind, an unfaithful one. Theirs was a different way of life. Two men went into the land with God, and 10 men did not. So that when they got into the land, they saw precisely the same things, but they saw them through different eyes. The 10 saw cities that they said were walled up to heaven, high and lofty and heavily defensed, and thick walls, they said, gates with bars. No chance of getting in there, they said. And the others saw the same walls, just as high, just as thick, the same gates, the same defences, but saw them with the eye of faith, and saw the time when Jericho's walls would fall flat with a shout, if God were with them. The 10 saw giants, and they said, we were as grasshoppers in their sight. They marvelled at their stature. And the others saw the same giants, just as high, but they saw them with the eye of faith, and they saw forward to the time when David would slay Goliath. The bigger the giant, the harder he'd fall. Didn't matter if God were with you. It made no difference. And the 10 saw themselves, as Israel was described on a subsequent occasion, as 2 flocks of kids in the wilderness. And the 2 saw the hosts of God encamping round about them, for there are more that be with us than that be with them. Or, there is no restraint with the Lord to save by many or by few. It wasn't that they saw things any different, brethren and sisters. It was just that they saw them differently. Theirs was a different attitude of mind and a different way of life. Now that faithlessness, characteristic of the 10 and of the nation in general, is highlighted in subsequent verses here in Deuteronomy chapter 1. Have a look, for example, at verse 30. The Lord your God, which goeth before you, he shall fight for you, according to all that he did for you in Egypt, before your eyes. Verse 32, yet in this thing ye did not believe the Lord your God, who went in the way before you, to search you out a place to pitch your tents in fire by night, to show you by what way ye should go, and in a cloud by day. They didn't realize it. And you notice that the same phrases are used there, as in verse 20, to draw the comparison, the contrast. Verse 20, they had said that they should send men to search out the land by what way we must go up. And Moses said it was the Lord who went in the way before you, to search you out a place. And they didn't realize it. It was God all the time, going before them, choosing the path, choosing the resting place, and ultimately choosing the place to set his name. And Israel did not see it. So it was, brethren and sisters, that sadly, even though literally they went into the land under Joshua, there was a sense in which they stayed outside in the wilderness. One generation had already died by the way of the wilderness. Because of their faithlessness, they were condemned to wandering 40 years until they had died. They become a pattern of life, the life that is lived by so many who do not have the hope of the kingdom and the place that God has chosen. They wandered, says Deuteronomy, round and round Mount Seir. It's interesting to see again the contrast that Moses makes. He talks about Mount Sinai, where they encamped and where God gave them the law, and God said to them after Mount Sinai, up, rise up and take your journey and go. And then, because of their faithlessness on the threshold of the land, he says, take your journey and go back again into the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea. And they wandered round and round Mount Seir, Moses says. They encompassed the mountain many days, going nowhere. having no destination now, no goal to their lives, just filling in the time and waiting to die, like so many in our world, just filling in the time between the cradle and the grave, not really going anywhere, having no aim in life, until the word of God came again. And Moses expresses it in the same terms again: up, take your journey and go. And they set off again towards the promised land. But not only did the old generation perish in the wilderness, brethren and sisters, but the new also, in a sense, stayed outside in the wilderness. For which reason, the writer to the Hebrews says, if Joshua had given them rest, then would he not afterwards have spoken of another Sabbath? There remaineth therefore a rest unto the people of God. Because they never really entered, never spiritually entered the land, never really became the kingdom of God that they were intended to be, not fully. There is some evidence that when Jesus was first baptized, he came from the direction of the wilderness and crossed Jordan into the land. And it is under him, brethren and sisters, in the kingdom, isn't it, who comes from the east, that Israel will truly be brought into the land. There are other little allusions to that fact, that Israel was still in the wilderness, or worse, still in Egypt. In the book of Hosea, the northern kingdom of Israel, to which Hosea was sent to prophesy, is called Ephraim. And it's interesting to try and determine why. All through the history of the kingdom in the Old Testament, there is a perpetual battle going on between the tribes of Ephraim and Judah. It's a fascinating study to take up, and to see how often these two are brought into close proximity and sometimes brought into conflict. It's very easy for us, with hindsight, knowing what has happened and what did happen, to be able to read the promises of Jacob to his sons in that way, seeing something at least of their fulfillment. It must have been very much more difficult for the sons who actually heard Jacob pronounce those blessings to interpret them as history unfolded. We won't do it now, but if we were to go to Genesis chapter 49 and look at the blessings of Jacob upon those tribes of Israel, brethren and sisters, we should find a most interesting comparison between the blessing of Joseph and Ephraim and Manasseh, who were his sons, and the blessing upon Judah. True enough, of Judah it was said that the scepter should not depart from Judah, nor the lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh should come. But wondrous things were spoken of Ephraim too, who was to be very fruitful. The bough that would run over the wall, a reference to the Gentiles being brought in to the hope of the Jews. And so on and so forth. And when they reached the land, the Shiloh that was mentioned in the promises to Judah became a place in Ephraim. And perhaps for that reason, Ephraim felt that the promise concerning Messiah related to him and his tribe. And Messiah would come from Ephraim. And Ephraim very much took the lead. You find Ephraim and Judah together in Caleb and Joshua. Caleb, possibly a Gentile, was nevertheless the representative of the tribe of Judah. He was the elder of that tribe. Joshua was from Ephraim. And it's Joshua who is in the ascendancy there, isn't it? It's Joshua who types our Lord Jesus Christ. It's Joshua who leads the people into the land. It's the Ephraim that seems to have it all its own way. You meet them a number of other times, and particularly significantly you meet them as the kingdom is divided after the reign of Solomon, and you have Rehoboam for Judah and Jeroboam for Ephraim. The kingdom splits into Judah and Ephraim. Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin, takes charge of the northern kingdom. The kingdom may well have become called Ephraim by the prophets, because Ephraim was the largest tribe territorially in the ten tribe kingdom. It may have been called Ephraim by the prophets because its first king, Jeroboam the son of Nebat, was from Ephraim. It may have been called Ephraim because Ephraim had always been an important center. Joshua had established his headquarters there. The tabernacle had been pitched at Shiloh. Joshua exhorted the elders from Shechem. Bethel was also in Ephraim. There was lots of interest and excitement and importance to be attached to the places in Ephraim. But it's significant too that Jeroboam the son of Nebat came back out of the land of Egypt to take the throne in Ephraim. 1 Kings chapter 12 tells us very plainly, it came to pass when Jeroboam the son of Nebat, who was yet in Egypt, heard of it, for he was fled from the presence of King Solomon, and Jeroboam dwelt in Egypt, that they sent and called him, and Jeroboam and all the congregation of Israel came and spake unto Rehoboam. 1 Kings 12 and the first three verses. And just as Israel, brought out of Egypt in the wilderness, persuaded Aaron to build the golden calf, so the Egyptian influence manifested itself again in Jeroboam. And Jeroboam immediately set about building two calves and placed one in Bethel and one in Dan, and commanded Israel that they should worship those calves. But perhaps, brethren and sisters, more important than all those things, the prophets call Israel Ephraim because Ephraim and Manasseh were born in Egypt. They were different from all the other tribes. Their origin was different. They were the sons of Joseph, born in Egypt of an Egyptian mother. Joseph was given to wife the daughter of Potipherah, priest of On. He married Asenath. And there was in the background of Ephraim and Manasseh that Egyptian influence that always seems to have called them back, so that throughout the prophecy of Hosea and elsewhere too in the prophets, you find continually the desire of Ephraim to go back to Egypt, to look to Egypt for help, for strength, for horses, for whatever. All the time, this anchoring back to Egypt and this Egyptian influence. So that there was a sense in which they too had never left Egypt, never come into the promised land, never made it to become the people of God. But it's earlier than that in their history that Psalm 78 has importance in this matter. For Psalm 78 seems to show that God rejected Ephraim at an earlier stage than the division of the kingdoms. When they were first established in the land, the tabernacle, as we said, was pitched in Shiloh, in Ephraim. And it was from there that the Ark of the Covenant was lost in battle to the Philistines. When Eli mourned that the glory was departed and fell backwards and lost his life. Psalm 78, then, from which earlier we read, says this. We began reading at verse 55. He cast out the nations also before them, and divided them an inheritance by line, and made the tribes of Israel to dwell in their tents. Yet they tempted and provoked the Most High God, and kept not his testimonies, but turned back and dealt unfaithfully like their fathers. They were turned aside like a deceitful bow. They provoked him to anger with their high places, and moved him to jealousy with their graven images. When God heard this, he was wroth, and greatly abhorred Israel, so that he forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent which he placed among men, and delivered his strength, the references to the ark, delivered his strength into captivity and his glory into the enemy's hand. The Philistines captured the Ark of the Covenant with disastrous consequences. He gave his people over also unto the sword, and was wroth with his inheritance. And then verse 67. Moreover, he refused the tabernacle of Joseph, and chose not the tribe of Ephraim, but chose the tribe of Judah, the Mount Zion, which he loved. And he built his sanctuary like high palaces, like the earth which he hath established forever. He chose David also his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds, from following the ewes great with young. He brought him to feed Jacob his people, and Israel his inheritance. So he fed them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them by the skillfulness of his hands. And there you have it, brethren and sisters. There's almost an implication there, isn't there, that God might yet have chosen Ephraim, that he might yet have been pleased to leave the tabernacle there and to bless Ephraim abundantly because of it, save that they were unfaithful, unwilling to become the place and the people that God had chosen, unwilling to have God dwelling in their midst. They did not wish to retain him, as ought to be an automatic reaction if you have a God. So that God refused the tabernacle of Joseph and chose not the tribe of Ephraim, as though it were ever in any doubt, as though he might have done. And he chose instead the tribe of Judah and David his servant. And so indeed it was, brethren and sisters, that the ark was brought from Kirjath-Jearim in Judah, and ultimately by David, though not without problems, brought up to Jerusalem and placed in the curtains that David had made for God. Return, O Lord, unto the many thousands in Israel, they said, as the ark came to rest, and the Lord of hosts, the many thousands of Israel, found his dwelling place at last. The tents that David made were succeeded by the temple that Solomon his son built. It was not to be a permanent structure, but it was for the moment the place that the Lord had chosen. And 1 Kings chapter 8 tells us of that very thing as Solomon dedicates the temple in his prayer. 1 Kings chapter 8, just a couple of verses to pick out. Verse 44, "If thy people go out to battle," says Solomon, "against their enemy, whithersoever thou shalt send them, and shall pray unto the Lord toward the city which thou hast chosen," the city which thou hast chosen, Jerusalem, "and toward this house that I have built for thy name, then hear thou in heaven their prayer and their supplication, and maintain their cause." And verse 48, "And so return unto thee with all their heart and with all their soul in the land of their enemies which led them away captive, and pray unto thee toward their land which thou gavest unto their fathers, the city which thou hast chosen, and the house which I have built for thy name, then hear thou their prayer and their supplication in heaven thy dwelling place, and maintain their cause." And again, brethren and sisters, it is the place which the Lord hath chosen. Not permanently, but for the time being. The ark has found its resting place. God has made them to know the place of his choice, the place of his dwelling. And just now, as Israel were clustered around the tabernacle in the wilderness and looking inwards to the things of God, so now in the land they have at last a permanent center, a temple, and the ark, and the things of God to cluster around, to dwell with him, to provide him a place where he might be their God and they might be his people.